just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm
Good morning and welcome to the Library Show here on KCAW Raven Radio in Sitka. My name is Brooke Schaefer and I'm your host this morning, and I'm joined by one of my favorite readers. Paul Norwood has come to the studio today to talk about books and magazines, I think. Paul, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Paul is an avid reader, and he has brought quite a stack of books to talk about today. So why don't we just jump into the first book you would like to talk about?
Okay. So the first book I'd like to talk about is called SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. And it's by Mary Beard, who is a British scholar, I believe, from Oxford. And it's a very interesting book, I think. It doesn't get to the period where Rome becomes Catholic. I guess it's kind of a weird thing to say. Christian. It's kind of before Catholics were Catholics. And so it doesn't quite cover that period. It goes up to it. And the reason it's interesting is not because it's a blow-by-blow account of the history of the Roman Empire or any dynasties or any particular peasants or cultural shifts. It's because the way in which it's told is applicable to almost any history.
What do you mean by that exactly?
And because she tells the story of Rome through her own interpretation of how history is told, how history is written down, retold, turned into myths, altered, and then completely lied about, then turned into propaganda, and then researched, and then forgotten, and then researched again, and then dug up by archaeologists. And in a way, it's a fascinating look at not only the history of Rome, but the way in which we get at the past, why it's important, and how we can kind of look into it and learn about it, learn from it.
So would you say it's almost kind of a commentary on history itself? Like...
Yeah, basically. And at all points through this book, it's not a book that's going to be fascinating about the sordid details of Caligula and Nero and the minute-by-minute account of the murder of Julius Caesar. It's, in fact, a story of people, a story of economics, agriculture, a story of what we know, what we don't know, why we know it, why we don't know it, and why it's important. And I selected a very short piece in here.
Great.
And this is kind of from early Rome, a period in Roman history that we talk about because people want to cover it, but people don't tend to express just how little we know about this period of history. And it's easy to open a history book and think, this is history, capital H. But in fact, it's mostly conjectures. So here it says, at this point, a reality check is required. However else we may choose to describe the urban community of the early Romans, it remains somewhere on the spectrum between tiny and small. Population size in what is effectively prehistory is notoriously difficult to estimate. But the best guess is that the original population of Rome, at whatever moment it was when the aggregate of little settlements started thinking of itself as Rome, amounted to at most a few thousand. By the time the last king was thrown out, towards the end of the 6th century BCE, according to standard modern calculations, we are probably dealing with something in the region of 20,000 to 30,000 inhabitants. This is only a best guess based on the size of the place, the amount of territory that Rome probably controlled at that point, and what population we could reasonably expect to support. But it is more likely that the exaggerated totals that ancient authors give, correction, it's much more likely than the exaggerated totals that ancient authors give. Livy, for example, quotes the very first Roman historian, Quintus Fabius Pictor, who wrote around 200 BCE and claimed that toward the end of the regal period, the number of adult male citizens was 80,000, making a total population of well over 200,000. This is a ludicrous figure for a new community in archaic Italy. It is not far short of the total population of the territories of Athens or Sparta at their height in the mid-5th century BCE, and there is no archaeological evidence for a city of any such size at this time, although the number does at least have the virtue of matching the aggrandizing views of early Rome found in all ancient writers.
So I see what you mean now by a kind of, she's definitely taking a look at the history itself, like how history gets told, like why would the person have lied about the population of Rome, and so we have to examine our resources, not just the history that we're told.
That's right. And also we have to examine our own biases. So, for example, when we buy a textbook of U.S. history, it starts with the Jamestown colony and so on. And because it takes up so many chapters, we tend to think that it's more significant than it really is, that they are more like us, that they are less like someone else. But in fact, those people were barely connected to the United States in any way.
Oh, right. They were more coming from England.
Barely English people. There were hardly any of them. They had hardly any impact on the landscape, on the culture. And yes, they belong in the first chapter, but their outsized presence in the chronology is easy to turn into some kind of supposed importance in the greater history of today. And not to diminish what they did, which was great, but had they landed in Brazil or Guyana rather than where they landed, which is modern-day United States, it would not have changed anything about our history. What really changed it was larger and larger and larger colonies later. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to think about those events and the way we tell history and the way a history of which we know the end, it's really easy to say hindsight 2020, everybody in Rome was bounded for no good. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have that. And instead, we are in the situation that the Romans were in, where they're mythologizing their pasts, mm-hmm. and they're thinking that they're on a particular trajectory when they may or may not have been on a trajectory. Now we know.
Right. So, and that's pretty typical of the whole book, the SPQR, where she kind of has these little asides and kind of commentary about, like, reality check. Here's what's really going on.
It is. Although I do have to say that we pretty much get her philosophy by the time we're 2/3 of the way through the book. And then because I'm myself less interested in knowing which emperor came before which, towards the end of the book, there's a little bit more on economics and other interesting things, but we pretty much get her philosophy by the time we're 2/3 of the way through.
Before we move on, I have a couple questions. I guess one of them is the title of the book, which is The Four Letters. And can you explain that?
That's right. I should have had the book opened at where it explains that, but it's Senatus Populusque Romanus, I believe. And so it means the Senate of the people of Rome,
Okay. Basically. Okay.
And it's what was written on banners. And if you see old, not even because there's no pictures, obviously, but cartoons of Romans like charging through something, you'll see their little eagle. And it later inspired the Nazis. So it looks like a Nazi banner.
Okay.
And then underneath it, it says SPQR.
Okay.
Basically, that's it.
And maybe you said this already, but she is a historian. Is that correct?
She's a historian.
Okay.
Yes.
And a professor at Oxford.
I believe it's Oxford, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, it sounds like an interesting book. And what is the next book you have in your giant stack?
So the next book is a brand new book. It just came out. It's available at Old Harbor Books. It's called Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast.
All right.
And it's kind of a change of pace, I guess, from the SPQR book. It's also nonfiction. And it's called A Comprehensive Guide to the Fungi of Coastal Northern California. And you're probably thinking, meh, I might not buy that book because I hardly ever go to coastal Northern California, or maybe I never go there. But this guy has been here. And
recently, right? He was just here last fall. Is that correct?
That's right, I think. Yeah. And he drew a lot of parallels between the mushroom flora down there and the mushroom flora up here. They're similar, especially the ones under spruce. And it's pretty close to as complete of a mushroom flora as you can get in pictures for here. And it's pretty.
Could you actually use it for here?
And there's really good notes. The notes are very good. I don't think he wrote them. The other writer is Christian Schwartz. I think Christian Schwartz wrote the notes, the text, and he took the pictures.
The gentleman's name? Who is
Noah here? Siegel.
Okay. Yeah,
he was here with his wife or girlfriend. And, so very good book, highly recommended. Costs $35, which is pretty cheap for that size, color, and weight book. If you want more of a field guide, there's another book by Steve Trudell that's very good also. It's published by Timber Press. I don't have it here.
So that book that you do have here, you would not call a field guide. This is more something that you would look up at home. If you found an interesting mushroom, you might come back and refer to it. Or is it more just someone who's interested in mushrooms and wants to like see a picture of a mushroom and then read about it? How would you describe it?
I think you're right. It's a good book to have at home as a reference. It probably wouldn't do well in the rain. And the nice thing about mushrooms is that they're highly portable.
Right.
And you can bring them home. You can look them up. Most people don't want to look mushrooms up in the field because it's cold. It's raining. So it's nice to have a field guide. But realistically, most mushrooms that you really have a question about, you'll bring home. And it'll take a really long time to figure out what they are. They're pretty complicated creatures.
You could use this like a field guide, though? Like you could use it at home to help you identify a mushroom?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is a very handsome book, I have to say, looking at it here in the studio. It's bigger than a field guide for sure, and it has wonderful color pictures.
That's right.
Yeah, a nice book.
There's another book, yet another book that came out, Mushrooms of California. Came out 2 years ago, I think, or 1 year ago. It's also very handsome, very complete, but the cover is not as nice. It's bigger. It's a little bit more expensive.
So I'm curious, this particular mushroom author, Noah, is he planning on doing, that you know of, doing something about the mushrooms in this part of the country, since he was up here and taking pictures and looking for mushrooms? Do you know?
I haven't heard of anything.
Okay, so we might not. Maybe we can expect something from him, but we don't know yet.
That's right.
Okay. What's next in your stack?
The next one is a magazine. It's The Economist. And I subscribe to The Economist, but so does the library.
That's right.
And you can also buy it at Harry Race. Is it Harry Race, the one downtown?
The one downtown, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Which also has a great magazine selection. So there's lots of good magazines at the library, like Fine Home Building and so on. And then also good magazines at the pharmacy. And there's also some good ones at C-Mart. So
nice.
We actually have a great selection here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a few at the bookstore. So
why do you subscribe to The Economist? Why is this one of your...
I know. Because it's a British publication, so it's a step removed from us, which is kind of nice. It gives a slightly different look at the world, slightly more... they're not as invested in party politics as maybe other publications would be that are here. For example, The Nation or Time magazine would have pretty strong ideas of where they stand. There's not much of a conservative weekly here, but there's a few conservative monthlies. I like it because also it's well written and it has kind of a wry sense of humor. And it's interesting to read. Also, it's interesting to read the letters. It's quite a lengthy magazine to read. It's probably got 2.5-3 times, I would say, the content that Time magazine does.
Hmm. Because it doesn't have ads, or
it's
just
thicker
they pack
to begin
it
with.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Time magazine might have fewer pages to begin with. It does have ads, maybe not as many.
It does do something that's I think a unique thing that you've mentioned to me before, that the articles are not attributed to a specific author. And I was wondering if you could speak about that.
I know, that's kind of an interesting policy, and kind of an inconvenient policy too, because, for example, I brought another magazine here, which is the New York Review of Books. I look for these writers. Like, right. I'm not so much interested about what they're writing about as who is writing it. So, for example, here, Martin Fuller, their architecture commentator, one of their architecture commentators is writing an article about Maya Lin. And so I'm looking forward to reading that because it's him writing. Whereas if it were somebody else writing it, I might be less excited. So there's a few other writers that I really look forward to in there. I don't have that option in The Economist.
Which seems like you tackle reading The Economist maybe a little bit differently as a result. Like you kind of try to read it page to page, like from front to end. And maybe with the New York Review of Books, you don't do that. I'm not sure. You could speak to that.
You're right. And so it makes it to where I kind of make it kind of a duty to read The Economist as thoroughly as possible, because it also makes me learn about things that maybe I'm less normally likely to look into. So things like macroeconomics and business that run our world, things like the inner workings of the UN or China. So these things are extremely important, but it's easy to just read about the latest Trump-Hillary spat. Mm-hmm. And really, there's only so much information in that.
Would you say that do you notice that the tone is the same throughout the whole thing? Like, do you think that there's an editor going through and trying to create a certain tone for all of the articles that aren't attributed to a specific author?
You're exactly right. Now, there are some columns, but the tone is the editor's power must be almost limitless, because it's a very smooth reading magazine. It's almost the same all the way throughout, except for one issue a year. And then in the back, however, there's the obituary writer. Her name is Anne Rowe, I found out. She's a scholar of poetry, and she's amazing. She's a great writer. So if you pick up an Economist and you only have a little bit of time, you're just trying it out, read the letters to the editor and the obituary, and then everything else.
I can comment, as someone who doesn't read The Economist, that I have read the obituaries from that magazine at times. You have shared ones with me, and they're a delight to read. They're highly entertaining and usually pretty moving, and it doesn't matter if they're about someone I know about or not. The writing is really well done, and it's kind of like an entertainment piece, interestingly enough. So I can recommend the obituaries as well in The Economist. But so then you have the New York Review of Books in front of you next, which is another magazine that you read. That sounds like it's entirely different than The Economist, or it's more typical in that the authors are named and you read it for the authors. You've come to like certain writers. Is that what you would say? Or why do you read this one?
That's exactly right. I like it for the writing, and also because I read it for the writing, and while I'm reading these articles by people that I think write well, I'm learning almost by osmosis about the things that they've been assigned to write about, which are usually things they're interested in. And there are writers that I never would have heard of. There's some very famous, such as Joyce Carol Oates. I always read everything she writes for the New York Review of Books. But then there are writers that I otherwise never would have heard about. One of my favorites is a staff writer for the Irish Times, and he's just excellent. Mm-hmm. So I always read his stuff.
Is it the New York Review of Books that turned you on to, because I think you went through a phase where you tried to read a lot of Joyce Carol Oates' novels as well. And was it because of the New York Review of Books?
And that's right. I'd never read her fiction before. Sometimes she also publishes fiction. For example, this month's Harper magazine has some of her fiction, so you can read that at the library or buy it from the pharmacy. And but for the New York Review of Books, she only publishes reviews, obviously. And she must never sleep. Now, if you've ever seen a picture of her, she looks like she's
skinny
to the point of worrisome. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd be really worried about her health. She's so skinny. Mm-hmm. She must not sleep. She will review Dostoevsky She will review the whole works of Dostoevsky and actually read it and then compare it to the works of other relevant writers with just a disarming breadth of knowledge. Mm. And she's, I think, a professor at a leading university that she commutes to. I don't know how she does it. She's up there in age. And she publishes right. something like 1.5 books a year or something. It's yeah. unbelievable.
She's so prolific. Yeah. Anything else about this particular magazine that you... Is it mostly in reviews of books? I mean, the title of it makes it seem that it would be all reviews of books. Is that true?
You're right. It's not totally... And I think maybe they just get to liking the writers, and so they just let the writers get away with stuff that they probably shouldn't get away with. But, yeah, generally they're reviews of books, sometimes of very obscure books, sometimes of very well-known books or works of art, opera. It could be anything. But also there are people, for example, here, Judge Jed Rakoff writes about terror and the Constitution. Hmm. And so that sometimes will kind of be presented as a review, but it's not really a review. It's just an article.
Okay.
And it's... if you're trying to read more things on one side of the political spectrum than the other, it's kind of left of center. It's definitely left of center. And okay. then The Economist would be on social issues to the left of center, and on macroeconomics and so on, they would be to the right of center. So they're kind of neither here nor there by American standards.
Hmm. Okay. They both sound like interesting periodicals. One more than the other, I would say. But what's next in your pile there?
So next I have Gilead by Marilyn Robinson.
Oh, this is the woman who did an interview with President Obama. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
So better than the book. It's kind of like sometimes the New York Review of Books, the reviews are better than the books.
Right.
But this is a clear case of the book is great, the interview is better. I go online and find the two-part interview of Marilyn Robinson by Barack Obama. And he is, I think it's supposed to be the other way around, but it's an amazing conversation. I think it's called something like A Conversation with Marilyn Robinson. It's in two parts. It's on the New York Review of Books website. You can read the text. You can listen to the audio. And it really is a perceptive, very interesting interview. And it really kind of makes light of the book, makes light of the author, makes light also of our president.
So, and the interview was not about this particular book that you have with you, or was it?
It was in part, yeah, about this particular
okay.
book. That was the main thing.
Okay.
And this book is about a preacher. Mm-hmm. A preacher and a family of preachers. It's about the preacher and his father and his grandfather and his young son. And it spans about 100 years of American history. And it starts kind of, in fact, over 100 years, because many of them had kids when they were older. And it talks about Bloody Kansas, just before the Civil War. And it's fascinating, very slow and reflective book. It's... of course, there are preachers, and it's a lot about the Bible and preaching and sermons and family dynamics and the Midwest. And it's, I think, really great.
And would it be to give too much away if you maybe talk a little bit about the title?
Gilead is the name of the town.
Oh, it's the name of the town. Okay.
Yes. And
okay.
I think it's a fictional town.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes it sound like a medieval warrior or something. But
right.
It's the name of a town.
Okay.
That's all.
Okay. Oh, interesting. And it looks like you might have some passages marked. Do you have sections to read to us from there?
I do.
Great.
I do have a couple of passages marked. And a lot of it is written, in fact, pretty much all of it is written as a letter to his young son. He married late and had a very young son, and he's going to die soon. And his son is too young to get this. So he's writing this as a letter to his son for when his son is old enough to understand more difficult things about life.
Okay.
I have been thinking about existence lately. In fact, I have been so full of admiration for existence that I have hardly been able to enjoy it properly. As I was walking up to the church this morning, I passed that row of big oaks by the war memorial, if you remember them, and I thought of another morning, fall a year or two ago, when they were dropping their acorns, thick as hail almost. They were all sorts of thrashing in the leaves, and there were acorns hitting the pavement so hard they'd fly past my head. All this in the dark, of course. I remember a slice of moon, no more than that. It was a very clear night, or morning, very still, and there was such an energy in the things transpiring around those trees, like a storm, like travail. I stood there a little out of range, and I thought, it is all still new to me. I have lived my life on the prairie, and a line of oak trees can still astonish me. I feel sometimes as if I were a child who opens its eyes on the world once and sees amazing things it will never know any names for, and then has to close its eyes again. I know this is all mere apparition compared to what awaits us, but it is only lovelier for that. There is a human beauty in it, and I can't believe that, when we have all been changed and put on incorruptibility, we will forget our fantastic condition of mortality and impermanence, the great bright dream of procreating and perishing that meant the whole world to us. In eternity, this world will be Troy, I believe. And all that has passed here will be the epic of the universe, the ballad they sing in the streets, because I don't imagine any reality putting this one in the shade entirely, and I think piety forbids me to try.
Wow. Do you have another passage marked, or was that all you wanted to read from it?
I have another short one. I don't know if we have... I'll try it. For who among men knoweth the thing of a man, save the spirit of the man which is in him? In every important way, we are such secrets from each other, and I do believe that there is a separate language in each of us, also a separate aesthetics and a separate jurisprudence. Every single one of us is a little civilization built on the ruins of any number of preceding civilizations, but with our own variant notions of what is beautiful and what is acceptable, which, I hasten to add, we generally do not satisfy, and by which we struggle to live. We take fortuitous resemblances among us to be actual likeness, because those around us have also fallen heir to the same customs, trading in the same coin, acknowledge more or less the same notions of decency and sanity, but all that really just allows us to coexist with the inviolable, untraversable, and utterly vast spaces between us.
I remember that, actually, a passage that you have read it to me, I think, at home at one point, and I think that passage is beautiful. I don't know how it makes you feel. I could see a little bit of sadness to it for sure, but I find it personally, I find it kind of a beautiful passage to acknowledge the reality in which we live. But why did you choose that particular piece? Did you just like the writing, or?
I like the writing and the philosophical approach mm-hmm. to theological problems.
Thank you for sharing that one with us. You've got a couple more books in front of you. I'm not sure if we'll have time to go over both of them, but maybe choose the one you most want to talk about, just in case we can't get to the other one.
So how about just one? We have How to Read a Modern Painting, Lessons from the Modern Masters. It's by John Thompson, and it's published by Abrams. Abrams is a more affordable publication of art books, and I found that it's very, very, very well done. It's kind of a conversation on art. It's kind of like walking through a museum and having a little bit of conversation with quoting from other artists. On one page, there'll be a reproduction of the artwork, and on the other page, there'll be a little story about the painter and the frame, history at the time, and related ones.
I'd love to talk more about it, but I think that's all the time we have this morning. Thank you so much, Paul Norwood, for coming in and being on The Library Show. And thank you all for tuning in to Raven Radio, KCAW Sitka.